Hello, and welcome to the Commander Theory Podcast. I'm Nick Beatman, and I'm here with my friend, Zach Mack.
Hello, theorists.
So this episode is going to be a little bit outside our normal wheelhouse. This is all about the storyline of March of the Machines. So that just wrapped up on Tuesday of this week. There is more coming with March of the Machines, the aftermath. That's going to be those stories are going to get here on May 1st. But I had a lot of thoughts about this storyline. I wanted to share them somewhere. This is going to be an extremely spoilery ep. Do not listen to this if you haven't yet finished this reading up to date with the stories. But before we jump in, I want to briefly talk about our Patreon. If you head on over to patreon.com/commandertheory, you can support the show and get sweet benefits, including ad-free episodes for as little as $1 a month. If you aren't ready to be a patron yet, you can help us out by rating or reviewing us wherever you get your podcasts. All right. So everyone who's still here has read the stories, so I'm going to assume you know the gist of what has happened, and I'm just going to critique it. I'll call it like I see it. I think there was a huge problem in the storyline with a lack of tension. In addition to like sort of the main storyline, just following like Elspeth and Chandra and Ren doing their little strike team into the heart of New Phyrexia, there were all these side stories that were going on. And most of these side stories focused on how the Phyrexians were woefully unprepared for the natives of pretty much every plane they invaded. So like Ikoria, Ixalan, Innistrad, Eldraine, like all these planes kind of already like had the invasion handled. That's what we saw in the storyline. So like the actions of the main characters didn't really matter that much. Like if the Phyrexians can't stand up to the natives of like these planes, then it's not really so important that like Elish Norn dies or a Realmbreaker gets turned off or whatever. It's just like kind of pointless, you know? And also like just like the invasion plan in general is kind of ridiculous. Like I think part of the reason that the original invasion storyline, like with, Yawgmoth and Urza, part of the reason it was so satisfying is because like Yawgmoth seemed like a real threat. The heroes were constantly on the back foot, and it was only like because Urza had also spent thousands of years preparing for the invasion that, you know, he was able to create the legacy weapon, and that was what killed Yawgmoth and ended the invasion. It was the culmination of like a lot of time, both in the world of the game, but also like real world time, because we followed the Weatherlight for so many years leading up to this moment. But even though there's clearly been a lot of time leading up to this, you know, New Phyrexia was in, I think, 2010. That's a 13-year gap for Wizards to figure out exactly like how this plot line is going to go. And then like, you know, we saw it reemerge in Kaldheim. And so we've had like over a year just with the Phyrexians being like in the front of the storyline. And yet like we are just constantly being shown how Norn is incompetent. Like when we went back to New Phyrexia with the All Be One storyline, like she's just doing things that are obviously stupid. Like they, she has this habit of like incorporating the highest performers in the machine orthodoxy, like into the architecture, basically turning them into statues and effectively killing them. So she's set up a system where she guarantees that like if you're good at your job, you will die. And if you're bad at your job, you get to keep doing it. This is not somebody I'm going to be afraid of. I want a plot line where the villains are terrifying, the villains are threatening, and like the heroes have to take incredible measures and get really lucky to overcome like huge odds. But like just constantly, like the Phyrexians are just doing stuff that makes no sense and is obviously going to fail. Like they sent their, you know, their biggest Phyrexians to Ikoria, and they're like dwarfed by the Titans there, by the gargantuan monsters that live there. But why even try to do that? Like if you have this super effective contagion, like one poke from a plague stinger will do all the work for you. So that's why?
Actually, yeah, that's actually the point that I think is most upsetting to me is so like at this point in time, I have not finished the mom storyline, but this is something that with the one stories, like everything leading up to this, like seeing the Praetors on starting in Kaldheim and like Jingataxis and Kamigawa, like Neon Dynasty, you know, all of everything we've seen. Something that upset me the most was that like in Scars of Mirrodin, it was like, oh, it only took a little bit of oil stuck on Karn to like take this plane over and create new Phyrexia. Like All you need is some oil and time and you got it, which makes like everything else feel really dumb in comparison. Because if like they were looking to do something like this with like the Realmbreaker tree or something, like you got Vorinclex to Kaldheim, just like let him hide out for a while, infect some people, you know, do the Phyrexian thing. Like all of the decisions seemed really, really meaningless. Like in all of the storylines, like why is Vorinclex looking for like the sap of Yggdrasil, like, or the world tree, I guess, in the story, you know, like, oh, cause he's going to make a Phyrexian one. Why doesn't he just infect it? Like, you know, there's a bunch of stuff. Like the only one that made sense was the Kamigawa storyline where it's like, yeah, this plane has like physical forms for spirits, so we're learning how to Phyrexianize spirits. And you're like, oh, that's like impactful and like meaningful because they've never been able to do that before. And then everything after that again was like, I'm on Dominaria and I'm Shieldred and I'm gonna kill you. And you're like, why are you doing this?
Like, it's not clear at all like why, like what the invasion of Dominaria, the new invasion, was supposed to accomplish.
Yeah, like exactly.
I mean, it kind of worked out for them, I guess, because they like got to destroy the Silex. But do they even know about the Silex? Like, and also, like, they captured Karn, but like, why does that matter? Like, really, Karn is just like a trophy. It's not. Yeah. He doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it doesn't. He did his thing. He jump started your society again. Oops! Like, I got oil on my shoe, and now the Phyrexians are back. Like, he's already dealing with that really poorly in the storyline, right? Like, he's like, man, I feel really bad about this. I got to blow up a whole plane now.
Yeah.
And that's probably where they should have left it. You know, like, there's not really a reason that he had to be important to the storyline at all past, like, I have a personal commitment to destroying Phyrexia because I feel responsible for it.
Like, yeah, it's more they just like wanted him to be there in the room and couldn't think of like a better way to do it than just the Phyrexians take him as a trophy, even though, you know, he's not mission critical at all.
Yeah. So all of the whole plan, it felt pretty bad. It was kind of though like similar to when they do stuff with Nicol Bolas, where you're like, this is a dragon who's had centuries to like create and plan this like big bad thing, but what does he want? Just like power. You're like, that's so like nebulous and feels awful. And it's like, well, okay, the Phyrexians are supposed to be like the biggest baddies in the multiverse. They're supposed to be like completely critical thinking, like unfeeling machines that do like what is necessary. And then this was what they did. it's like anyone who is even critical at all can see like the flaws in the plan.
so like they just, so obviously like they are converting people wherever they go. So why aren't they like using the knowledge of those natives they're assimilating to like plan their invasion better?
Yeah, exactly.
because like we've seen a picture of like what's it called, like Norn's Inquisitor, this like Innistrad-y person who's being converted into a Phyrexian. So why didn't this person just say like, oh, Nephalia's got a million zombies, you can't convert, you should probably focus on a target that has like living things that'll replenish your ranks. But that never happened. They just kept throwing bodies against the zombies over and over. And like, if they had attacked literally anywhere else on Innistrad, they could, you know, they'll lose some guys, but they'll convert more. And then their army is like able to keep going. But they like made the worst possible decision. They like didn't collect any intel. And then when things were going badly, they just like doubled down. Like, this is stupid. This is not the behavior of like an intelligent enemy.
Yeah. So that just felt bad the whole time. It was almost like it was like just set up for failure. And that sucks because they are such a cool enemy. And like on paper, like all of the blurbs and all of everything we've read about these characters, Elish Norn, Vorinclex, whoever it was, you know, Jyngataxius was like so cool and like diabolical. And you're like, wow, that's great. I can't wait to see that in action. And then we get to see it in action and like it's like a someone shot you with like a one of those party favor squirt guns. You're like, that was it? Like that weak little thing? Come on, man.
Yeah, and let's jump to sort of the very end of the March of the Machine storyline, because this is extremely contradictory with everything we already know. It's like the thing I hate most about this storyline, which is that it ends with a complete reset to the status quo. And they accomplish that by making it so that like the moment Elish Norn dies, basically all the Phyrexians and all the Phyrexian oil on all planes shuts down immediately. Everything we know about the oil, like you mentioned earlier, a single drop of it converted the entire plane of New Phyrexia. So you're basically, it's just not even Phyrexian oil anymore if you are making it so that it just doesn't work. If there's like a single point of failure that shuts off the like most virulent substance in the multiverse.
Yeah, it really like spits in the face of it. Because this is something that a lot of people have talked about since like Game of Thrones and the TV show ending, which was different because they were like, we're not really sure what George R.R. is going to do. Like, and Star Wars, there's been like a lot of discussion about like fan pushed like media where they try to make it like satisfying. It really feels like they were trying to like rush this, and they were really ignoring the parts of the like what made Phyrexians cool and what made like the oil such like an interesting topic by like all of the fan theories that everyone had were kind of rendered inert at the end
because they just changed because they like like, you know, if you were going to predict the mom storyline, there are a couple things you would take as a given, and one is like, well, this is what the Phyrexian oil has been communicated to us for decades. This is like, they've been very consistent in their description of how it works. And then oops, we're going to change it because it's inconvenient if we have gallons and gallons of oil across, you know, dozens of planes. Well, here's the thing. Yeah. If you wanted to be able to wipe the slate clean and not have to worry about the ramifications of like Phyrexian oil on a whole bunch of different planes, then how about you just don't use the Phyrexians as villains, or don't make them go on a whole bunch of planes? Like it is, it's not a good plan to like wage a war on 1,000 different fronts anyway. So
all at once, you know?
Yeah. So why not? Like you can just pull random like syllables out of a hat and make up a bunch of planes and have Phyrexia invade those, and then like even if the Phyrexians lose, the fact that, like, you know, Asgol or Moag or Tolvada or any of these planes nobody's ever heard of before, if they're corrupted with Phyrexian oil, it doesn't,
prevent you from going back somewhere that monetarily
like the major, the selling point sets, like the, you know, the Eldraines and the whatevers, the Dominarias, the sets that like actually matter in terms of the magic canon, those are all going to be fine. But you can have a bunch of, like, you can just set up a bunch of planes with the purpose of knocking them down again. And that's fine. Like, you're, you know, I'm sure there are lots of like concepts for planes out there that you think, we probably can't stretch, I don't know, Mesopotamian plane and like really have it resonate. So why don't we just like show it on a couple cards and have the Phyrexians come just wipe the place clean?
That's honestly, I feel that like they have this IP, they have these Phyrexians that are so cool because they're so infectious. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that there is gallons of Phyrexian oil on other planes from the storyline perspective. Like, now they're just a threat. Now it's like, you can bring them back as you need, but it does kind of like lead into like one of the next points. I don't know if there's more points you wanted to talk about here in particular, but like that this, you know what I mean? Like that there is no lasting consequence for any of these actions.
Yes.
Which sucks.
Yeah. And also, like, one thing I really got to say is I hate that we found, okay, obviously, like, it sucks that they wrote themselves into a situation where, like, they basically had to change the oil, or they, like, they just didn't want to deal with every plane having a little seed of corruption on it. They didn't really have to do that. Like I said, they could have just had them invade planes that didn't matter, or you could just not use the Phyrexians, whatever. There's options, but they felt they went down this path. And if they absolutely had to do it this way, like there's, I'm sure there's constraints I'm not aware of, but if you absolutely had to make it so that, okay, we're going to end this storyline with the, you know, as soon as Elish Norn dies, the oil shuts off everywhere and the corruption like is not a threat. Okay. Why didn't we find that out until after Elish Norn died? Like, shouldn't that have been like the motivation for the characters to go to New Phyrexia and try to kill Elish Norn? Because, I mean, basically, like, what happened in this storyline is a bunch of characters did a bunch of things on a whim, like, without really having a reason behind it. And then it just accidentally turned out to be the correct course of action, which is dumb as hell.
Yeah, like, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah, like Chandra, she went on this mission in New Phyrexia when everyone told her it's a bad idea, because it was a bad idea unless you knew something else. Like if Chandra had known, oh, if we kill Elish Norn, then the oil shuts off. Okay, then that's a real motivation for her character to do it, instead of just like, I'm impulsive, I think I can save Nyssa, I'm going to do it even though everyone tells me it's a suicide mission. Or like, okay, whatever, maybe they wanted to just emphasize the relationship there, fine. But like, why did Karn kill Elish Norn when she's like already proven herself to be incompetent? Like, he's got to know that, like, okay, there's still other Phyrexians who are alive. If he kills Elish Norn, some other Phyrexian is going to step up to take the mantle of like father of machines or mother of machines. And presumably it's going to be someone who's like a little better at planning invasions. So like really, you know, if your opponent is like messing up very badly, you should probably not interrupt them. And so like Karn didn't make any sense until, oops, I guess that shut off all the oil. Like, well, why not just make it so that he knows this? Why not just make it so that he knows it's the right decision to kill her, so that his action makes sense? Like, here's how I would have structured the story. if just like broad strokes here, rather than making it so that the Phyrexians are getting their asses kicked on every single plane, why not just make it so that the defenders are clearly losing on every known plane? It's super desperate, really grim. And then Urbrask, who is, you know, we already know that he's a traitor to Phyrexia, make it so that Urbrask finds out that all the invaders are directly under Norn's control, and have him tell the planeswalkers that, oh, this is the only way to end the invasion. You have to kill Elish Norn. And then, you know, Chandra and Ren lead another strike in a new Phyrexia to assassinate Elish Norn. So, like, everything turns out the same in the end, basically. The only difference is that there's way more tension because it looks really, really bad. And then you find out they have this slim hope, and then they go and, like, against incredible odds, they pull it off and they seal the Phyrexians away, and they end the invasion of all these different planes. Like, same outcome, but just a little minor change, and it just functions as a story way, way, way better. I don't know why they chose to do it the way they did. I'm wondering, like, do they want the people who are, like, fans of Ikoria or fans of Innistrad to, like, see their, like, heroes crushing the Phyrexians?
Yeah, who knows? Like, I feel like it's more impactful, and it makes you care about, like, if you care about Eldraine and you see that, oh no, they're, like, corrupting these fairies and nobles and people that I care about. Like, and then there's a chance to save them. Like, you would root for that chance to save them, right? As opposed to, like, here's this, we built up for decades, this, like, world-ending threat, like, crushing this world, but actually not really, they're doing fine. You know, like, that feels like shoehorned in, even as, like, a fan of one of the planes, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and you can, like, have your main characters doing cool stuff. You can have, like, yeah, Watley or, like, Issa and Geralf doing cool things while they are still losing really badly.
That's the coolest part of Jor Kadeen, was that he was like, yeah, we keep losing, but I'm gonna keep fighting, and I'm a bad mamma jamma for doing so. You're like, this is cool that he's doing this. So why, like, you can have someone who's, like, against insurmountable odds and have them be cool, and, you know, like, doesn't seem weird to me, you know?
I know. Very strange choices. Speaking of strange choices, do you want to move on to sort of, like, the next area of the story that I just, like, really dislike how they handled?
This is a really big one, too.
Yeah, so this is, like, unceremonious deaths for major characters. So over the course of the new Phyrexia storyline, a little bit happened in All Will Be One. Like, Shieldred got executed in All Will Be One. Vorinclex and Jyngataxius and Elish Norn all died as well. I think Urbrask, it's, like, left ambiguous. I think he's, like, being set up to be sort of the new head of a slightly more peaceful new Phyrexia. But I mean, villains can die. That's fine. Like, the nature of Phyrexia is that some other Phyrexian is going to step up. But, like, the way that some of these deaths were handled is just, like, insulting to anyone who ever thought that the Praetors were cool. So, like, literally, I'm just going to, like, read a quick quote from the storyline.
We've already talked about spoilers, but this is the moment when this is the one we're going to read is Vorinclex, right?
Yeah. So, like, Vorinclex is towering over Teferi, like, he's got him, you know, dead to rights. And then Teferi says, "Look behind you." The Praetor turns, snarling. A blazing sword severs Vorinclex's head from his body. One of the Askari, a woman named Shella, who often drank her comrades under the table, offers Teferi a hand up. He takes it, thanks her, and then she is gone. On a battlefield, there is always war work to be done. So Vorinclex was the apex predator of the deadliest jungle on New Phyrexia. And you can only keep that position if you kill absolutely everyone that tries to like hunt you or escape you. And so like, you know, he's been in life or death scrapes literally every day of his life. And you're telling me that like the only reason he hadn't gotten murked before now was that nobody had tried telling him his shoelaces were untied. Like nobody told him he had something on his shirt. Like nobody tried this like juvenile, like look behind you. Like, why would you ever do that? If you're like, why would you turn your back on the enemy who's right in front of you? It just makes, it's just like stupid. This is a, this is like, this is like Vorinclex is not only like an insanely powerful beast, but he's like an incredible warrior. Like, and also like, who is this person who kills him? Like, this is a nobody. It's not like a legendary creature. It's not a planeswalker. It's like a faceless mook named Shella, no last name, whose only notable characteristic is that she's an alcoholic. Like, what? Why not make it happen at the hands of somebody who matters? Like, you're basically just saying that Vorinclex got sniped by like a 1/1 soldier token. This is like the most faceless person. And it's not like they're setting her up to be anybody, because she's not mentioned at any point in the story following.
Yeah, she's gone. She's like, yeah. And then there's more work to be done.
Yeah, she gets like two sentences, and those two sentences encompass, I'm going to kill like one of the scariest people on this plane. And then like the same thing happens to Jingataxius, except even worse. So like,
oh yeah.
So Jingataxius, I'm going to read you two quick segments of the story here. Jingataxius rides atop a massive war machine. Long and narrow, it is bedecked with all manner of weaponry, blades, spikes, a great ram at its head, all this to protect its precious cargo, a vat filled with his own progeny. Writhing, newt-like creatures, ready to be born, press their featureless faces against the glass. And then a little bit later, "You won't hurt Teferi," a woman shouts. Teferi looks up to see her, one of the war clan's very own, a massive warhammer lifted high over her head, she soars towards Jingataxius. When she brings it down upon him, the war machine's glass cracks. Foul-smelling liquid gushes out, bathing Teferi in its filth. New clothing will be a small price to pay to see Jingataxius plummet into his own creation. Even smaller when his own creations start eating him. So, like, you're telling me that the smartest guy on New Phyrexia, like, wheeled out a piranha tank and then conveniently stood on top of it so that a nameless goon who's never mentioned again can knock him into it. And they've like consistently talked about how intelligent Jingataxius is. Like, he is kind of, in a sense, like the brains behind Elesh Norn. Like, if she didn't have him as an ally, she never would have figured out like how to turn planeswalkers into Phyrexians. Like, he's a brilliant researcher, and he, like, I don't know, didn't think to maybe train his own monsters not to attack him, or to just, like, maybe let them loose on the enemy and not be anywhere near it, instead of, like, immediately atop them on some very breakable glass. And it's like, everything we've been told about these characters is undone in this story. Like, okay, like Vorinclex is supposed to be absolutely terrifying. You never want to be like going up against him in a fight, unless you're a 2/2 knight token, I guess. Or like, you know, Jingataxius is a genius. He's like constantly planning, always seeing two moves ahead. But I guess he can't predict that if he stands on top of piranhas, maybe he'll get pushed in. Like, I hate this. I hate this so much. This is character assassination. this story is like propaganda written by the Gatewatch.
Yeah, it's a Jorkadine himself, like sending out pamphlets.
Yes.
Yeah, Malira was like, "Yo, these guys suck. Look at how bad they suck," and wrote this story. Yeah.
Yeah, just like cartoony caricatures of like Jingataxia slipping on a banana peel and falling into his death trap. Like, oh my god, this is so stupid. Okay. All right. One last thing I wanted to talk about the story, and then we can draw this episode to a close. Okay. The very ending of the story, New Phyrexia is sealed off. Basically, they use Realmbreaker to swap its position in kind of like phased out timeless part of the multiverse with or rather they're swapping Zalfir and its phased out timeless part of the multiverse with New Phyrexia. So they're sealing New Phyrexia off and they are bringing Zalfir like back into a part of the multiverse where it's accessible by planeswalkers. And this is like celebrated in the storyline as, you know, like Teferi kind of undoing this critical mistake he made during the first invasion for which he's felt so much guilt. But they also go out of their way to make it clear that Zalfir isn't being made whole. It's not returning to its place on Dominaria. It's just like its own plane now. So if you're like a citizen of Zalfir and you, I don't know, would like to visit any other part of your world, there's basically like no change at all for you. You are still cut off from the rest of Jomura, the rest of Dominaria. Like you cannot see the rest of your world. You are still trapped, but you know, occasionally a planeswalker can come and just like be a tourist in your little your tiny little country and just kind of like look at it. It's like you're living in a zoo essentially, and occasionally a planeswalker gets to like come into your little cell and piss on the ground or whatever and eat your food, and then they can leave and you're stuck there. Like, I don't understand how this is supposed to be like a victory or like anything meaningful for the people of Zalfir.
Yeah. because they've talked about how, so like in when the first like Dominaria the set released in whatever that was, 2018 or something like that, they talked about how like they were still in the two block model when they switched to the like one set model, and or like the standalone set model. And so like the first set was going to be here's Dominaria, and the second set was kind of implied to be like Knights and Zalfir, you know, like it's going to be Zalfir Returns. So it's kind of like I was kind of expecting that, you know, like, oh, Zalfir, like Zalfir's back and look how they've changed and there's all these knights and stuff, and like feels kind of weird that this is like they really just spark notes to their own like plan that they had for Zalfir to come back. That it's just super not impactful. This is something that people have been waiting for longer than Scars of Mirrodin, you know, like since the 90s. Like,
yeah. I mean, we talked about this. I think one of our first episodes ever, this was released right around the time of Dominaria, and we talked about this at the time. Like, yeah. I said, wow, I really, really wanted Zalfir to come back. I can't wait for it to finally happen. And it's like, well, you know, it's, I mean, that you're saying it's back, but no, it's pretty much the same for every Zalfirin. Incredibly. I was just incredibly disappointed with the culmination of the New Phyrexian storyline. It had like a lot of my favorite things, you know, obviously Phyrexians, Zalfir. I was really prepared to be pumped for this set, And I couldn't have been more disappointed with how it turned out. I think they, I don't know. I feel betrayed. how do you feel overall about just the March of the Machines storyline and like the culmination of this arc?
Yeah. So I feel like there's a huge disconnect between, the cards that we've seen spoiled and how the cards are handling the storyline compared to the story itself, where like there are cards spoiled. Like, let me read the flavor text of a card that we're not going to talk about on the show at all. There's it's an uncommon from the set. It's 6GG for an 8/8 trample hexproof. That's it, right? So perfect. A lot of room for flavor text. It's called Copper Host Crusher. This is a little spoiler for everybody. The flavor text says, walls built to withstand assaults even from Ikoria's apex monsters were quickly deemed tactically irrelevant by Vorinclex's forces. So that kind of like implies that like, oh, they're having a hard time over on Ikoria. But then you read the story and it's like the exact opposite. It's like, oh, all these Phyrexians came with their big monsters, but they weren't as big as Godzilla. And you're like... Oh, okay. Like, that's weird. So there, to me, really the biggest takeaway is like, I think what Magic should do moving forward with the story is like sets should have a story and they should have story beats. And I think that people would read the stories, like look at like the Horus Heresy series, right? Like it's like just shy of 50 books or something like that. Or it's like 40 something, 50 something books about the Warhammer 40K storyline, about like the Horus Heresy, where he like turns against the Empire and a bunch of stuff happens. That was written basically outside of all of the games and the splat books that come out and stuff like that, but has gotten a lot of critical acclaim by people over the years because they just kind of let an author, they're like, these are the points you have to hit. And then they let an author write it. And this is kind of what happened with like the Eldering storyline, like I can't remember what it's called. The Wilds, where the kids go off and do their thing and meet Garak or whatever. Like, that was a good little novella, and they just kind of let the author do what she wanted. That's mm-hmm. probably just what they should do. Like, I understand that they want to get people hyped for these sets, but like the cards do a pretty good job of that, and hitting on like key story points do a pretty good job of that. So why not just like either let people release books ahead of time and then make sets about them, or let the sets come out so you know the story beats and the characters and you have your flavor text and you're like, oh, who's like Crank Bucko, who says this funny quip on this red spell. Like, you can write him into a story and then just make a good story. Just let like somebody, instead of like all the pressure to put out a story in like, what, like 3 months or so, like, they don't give these people a very long time to write these stories.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the like the counter argument to that is what happened with the War of the Spark storyline. I think that they, because they did try to do that. And like, they got Greg Wiseman to write, you know, a real novel, 2 whole novels, recapping what happened in War of the Spark, or not even recapping, like, you know, just telling the story
listing.
From, yeah, yeah. From front to end. And everyone hated it. And I think that, like, I mean, it wasn't great, but it was also what really killed it was the fact that it was offensive. I think that I think that, like, that's not a terrible approach. I think I would have preferred to read March of the Machines in that kind of form, where it's one person who's fully responsible for it. And so they can see the tone and the story. They have like total control over the tone and the story, because part of the problem with the current approach is like, maybe, I mean, like, a lot of these side stories were written by different people than K. Arsenault Rivera, who did the like, you know, Chandra and Ren going on this mission in New Phyrexia. K. Arsenault Rivera handled all that part, but these side stories were written by different people. And so, like, that might explain why tonally there's a little bit of a problem across, like, when you take them all together holistically. Mm-hmm. like if a single person was handling all of these plot points, then they could probably, they could more easily see like, oh, well, you know, all these like other invasions that are going on, I should probably make it so that they seem pretty grim to like, you know, underwrite the importance of what's going on in this main plot line. But that's not what happened. And I would guess it's because like you can't, when you don't have full control over the story, you can't do those kinds of like coordination kind of things. Yeah. A lot of problems. I'm very disappointed with how things turned out. I'm okay with like the Phyrexians being kind of fridged. I would hope that like the next time they come around, they learn, at the very least, like learn from this and don't put a single point of failure for like every Phyrexian invader, so that you know, we just don't get the same thing happening next time, so that they can actually treat the oil like it should be treated, like be consistent with all the lore we've seen so far. But I don't know if we'll get that.
Bye. I think everyone agrees at this point that like something needs to be done about the story. Like, I guess needs to be done is pretty important, dire, you know, but like most people I've talked to, like read, like if they play Magic and they're into fantasy or sci-fi, like they have not enjoyed the story very much. And I think another part of that is that it's like you said, like it's ignoring the history, it's ignoring the lore that we've already established for these characters, for like this universe. So I think if there's so many things that they could do, like Wizards of the Coast is a huge money-making generator for the company. Like, can you just contract some authors to like write something for you? Like, like just like three decent authors that you like, just give them some money, tell them to do their thing. There's like, it'll work, you know? Like, I don't see why they don't do something like that, but they don't.
Yeah. And they've had good runs of the story. Just like, maybe we should have done this at the beginning, but to level set, like, what have been like your favorite Magic stories or like storylines, and what do you think is like different about how they were handling things then versus now?
Yeah, that's a good one. So I think the classic one is like when people talk about like the Ixalan storyline, that was them like fixing a lot of things in my like estimation. That was what I assumed was happening. Was with like Jace and Vraska, they're like, let's make Jace a likable protagonist. Let's set up this romance with Vraska, and like let's set up the arc for the next, you know, so and so years by like explaining that Bolas has this plot to like presumably trap planeswalkers because he stole a planeswalker trap, you know. But everything that was not Jace and Vraska in that story was pretty bad, you know. But I enjoyed the Dominaria storyline when we did get there, except for the Jace parts, because they didn't do anything there. And then like some of the books from the past, I really liked the Kamigawa short stories. And I really like the original Brothers War book, I think was really good. So there are points and authors that I really have enjoyed over the years.
I'll second both the like Ixalan and Dominaria storylines, you know, first Dominaria. I thought both of those were great, especially just like the strong focus on very few characters.
Much better that, for everyone.
Yeah, especially with like Ixalan, because we got like a whole story that was just like Jace being alone, dealing with his amnesia, and then really it was just focusing on him, his interactions with Vraska as they go through this thing. And another one I really liked was the like Eldritch Moon storyline, especially like the very ending of it.
Absolutely, yes.
That was super strong, possibly because it was like embracing a genre that Magic storyline like doesn't touch, and it was executed incredibly well. But I think that there's a couple things that were different, you know, back then. Like Dominaria, they just gave the entire thing to like one author who handled it the whole way through. She was really talented. I think Ken Moon was the guy who wrote the like culminating story in the Eldritch Moon storyline. And you could just tell this guy really knows his stuff when it comes to cosmic horror. There's just not that coherence with the March of the Machines storyline. And there's also, it's focusing on way too many characters at once, I think. Because they were trying to tie up so many different things. They were trying to like fix the Chandra Nissa relationship. They were trying to like end the Teferi and Zalfir like storyline that had been going on for half a decade. They were trying to like have Elspeth kind of ascend to a new type of being, and like they were trying to handle that. They were like having Wren's sacrifice. There's like the like curing of the like uncompletion of Nissa and Ajani, the deaths of the Praetors, like the invasions happening on so many different planes. It was just a lot of things to juggle. And I think it was like a really big ask. And the fact that it was spread across multiple authors didn't make it any easier. And I'm wondering if like maybe it just like the story team who is coordinating all this, perhaps like bit off more than they can chew, because it just did not turn out so well. I mean, that's the problem with like both War of the Spark and this, is that if you're trying to like, you know, give everyone all like the major characters something cool to do and wrap up a whole bunch of plot threads at once, it's just incredibly hard. It's just really, really difficult. And I don't think they've done a great job, like either of the two times they've done it so far, these like event sets.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of the same thing though with just movies in general. Like whenever the scope gets too large, like it feels unearned often. And like obviously like DC movies are very, very guilty of this. Like Marvel movies, especially nowadays, are more guilty of this, but like Iron Man 1 was just like, I'm Iron Man. There's another guy who's blowing stuff up. And it was fine, you know, it was great.
Yeah, it's about two guys.
Yeah. And then they fought and it was cool. And even like the Spider-Mans that we've gotten, it's like, there's a bad guy doing a thing and I'm going to stop him. And you're like, cool, great. You know, excellent. But then as soon as it's like world ending multiverse threat, like all of a sudden it gets kind of cheesy and it gets kind of hard to like feel like that's earned. And that's just what Magic keeps doing, is they keep pulling the DC where like every single threat is a world ending threat that must be stopped by the good guys or the bad guys will get their way. It's like, oh, okay. Come on now. Like, let's calm down a little bit. Let's have some fun. And then after like I know this is supposed to be the culmination of a big story, but like even that wasn't earned, because a lot of this wasn't handled in the sets that could have been handling it. You know, like we saw Vorinclex do a thing. Oh, we saw Jinkataxis do a thing. Oh, we saw Shieldred do a thing. Urbrass is being a weirdo, but like those were like mere glimpses into these sets that had a lot of other things going on. So it didn't really feel like the build up to anything. It felt like the setup and the come down all at once, which kind of sucks.
Yeah. And also like, it felt like every time we saw one of the Praetors, like in the sets leading up to this one, they like, I don't know, they didn't do a great job of like building up how threatening they are. You know, Vorinclex was like kind of on the run from Kaya, and like Kaya didn't seem to really feel threatened by him, or like Jinkataxius kind of you know, got his lab destroyed and like barely made it out of Neo Kamigawa alive. And then Shieldred's invasion faced like a ton of setbacks and got kind of beaten back on Dominaria. It's just like, can we just not make these guys threatening? Like, do you have to be doing, I don't know, like, given that we're leading up to March of the Machines, where the Phyrexian threat is like soundly defeated and we know that's coming, can we have a little bit of tension and a little bit of like fear for the future in the sets leading up to that? I don't know. All right, but I think that's all we have to say. Let us know your thoughts on the Phyrexian arc and the current storyline. If you know something happens in March of the Machine aftermath, such that we change our minds, then we'll come back and do an episode. But I'm not sure what could happen, really. But with that, I'm gonna close it out here. I'm gonna give a brief thank you to our Patreon patrons. They are Gustav, Ryan, Addison, Rick, Raphael, Kyle, Laser, Charlotte, Hannah, Andy, James, Bryce, Benjamin, Brandon, Kaidel, Jeremy, Russell, Dylan, John, John, Micah, Troy, Roxanne, Daniel, Andrew, Jason, Paul, Johan, Jonathan, Christian, Jim, Andrea, Vasilios, Logan, Fogelbrudel, Carl Oscar, Danny B, Jean-Francois, Drew, Recta, Nick, BJ, Cameron, Valerio, Quincy, Carrie, Stephen, The Longs, Vincent, Maceo, and Dylan. Thank you all for supporting the show. And if you're not currently a Patreon patron, but would like to become one, please check us out at patreon.com/commandertheory. Thanks for listening. You can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at Commander Theory.
And on Twitter, I am at Fat Bartleby.
You can also email us at commandertheory@gmail.com. Our theme song is Lincoln Continental by Nick Cage. You can check him out on SoundCloud.
And if you're interested in some other creative projects I'm working on, I have a band you can check out. We are a pink punk, pop punk band called The Have-Nots, all one word like cosmonauts. You can listen to all of our music for free right now. You can just head over to thehavenots.bandcamp.com. That is thehavenauts.bandcamp.com. And check us out. Let me know what you think.